This episode is sponsored by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Try for free at mailtrap.io. Hi, welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hello, Carlton.
Hello, Will.
And we're very pleased to welcome back Michael Kennedy from TalkPython. Welcome, Michael.
Hello, hello. It's amazing to be here on your show. Thank you, guys. Good to see you.
Yeah, thank you for coming on, Michael.
You are one of the original inspirations for this podcast. I was, I think, a guest on yours, and we were just talking off air. That was over 5 years ago, so it's time flies.
I can't believe it's been 5 years. It's just mental.
I know. But I said TalkPython. You have this whole constellation of things now as well, right? You have Python Bytes. You have your training courses. I feel like I'm missing something. Is that the full suite of things?
That's pretty much it. Yeah, to a tiny bit of conference speaking and stuff, a little bit of YouTube, but primarily TalkPython, Python Bytes, and the courses around it.
So you mentioned conference speaking. I saw you flashing by on the news this week or last week about some keynote somewhere exotic. What have you been up to?
Yes, I had a wonderful time. I got to go to give one of the keynotes at PyCon Philippines this year, which was very excellent. I think I'm over jet lag, and then we had daylight savings, and so, you know, that's how it goes.
Does that mean the kids get up earlier or later? I can't remember.
They are forced to get up earlier than they want.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, we lose an hour. Yeah.
But it's glorious. It's glorious. I live in the Pacific Northwest in the U.S., and it is like we have two seasons. We have summer and rain, and also that comes with darkness. It'll be dark at like 4:30 in the winter and rainy.
Yeah.
And the sun was out till past 7 last night. I feel like summer's already here, even though it's not. So no regrets.
Yeah, it makes a big difference. So.
I'm on team daylight savings. Let's go.
So how did you go in the Philippines? Tell us about your keynote. What did you talk about down there?
The keynote was super fun. It was called The State of Python in 2024.
Oh, that's good, because I wanted to ask you about that. I was like, what are your hot takes, Michael? Go on, give us your hot takes.
Yeah, my hot takes. What are my hot takes? Well, it's, you know, I think it's interesting to consider that in the Python space, it's so distributed, the directions, and it's like Brownian motion almost. Like stuff is just moving around and like whatever channels it takes and where traction gets for various projects, that's where the future goes, right? Even amongst the core devs, there's a bunch of them working on things. So if I went to a keynote or you went to a keynote at Apple, Tim Cook, you know, Tim Apple would come out and he would tell you, this is what we're doing with our new stuff, and this is what the team has been doing. You go to Microsoft Build or Google I/O, there are people who come out and say, here's the direction we've decided for you and us as a community. Hope you like it. There's none of that in Python, right? But partly because who's going to speak for the 10 different web frameworks and the 1,000 different data science things and all that kind of stuff, right? So I tried to put that together. I tried to say, like, all right, where's Python been last year? What's important, and where is it going in the future? So fun stuff.
Okay, so one problem I have. You know, I'm quite involved, but I'm very involved in Django, and I don't know anything that's going on over there. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh wow, there's this brand new thing. How do you keep up? How does one keep a kind of overview of what's going on in the different areas?
I have a bit of a cheat card. In that regard,
yeah, well, you got Python Bytes.
Yeah, I got Python Bytes, right? I got TalkPython, and I got Python Bytes. With TalkPython, I can dive into deep topics. Like one of the big things is, you know, the whole Astral UV stuff.
Yes,
that's going out, right? And so I'm talking to Charlie Marsh in 3 hours or something about UV, right? So I get to ask all those questions and kind of figure that stuff out. But then Python Bytes, like 6, 7, 8 topics that you've found every week, and you're going to not just get to, you have to find another 6 for next week. And so it just keeps you kind of on top of always searching.
But for the rest of us, we should just listen to your podcasts, right? That's how we keep up.
Take it on coast.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So we talked about this last time. I mean, when you're so involved in talking about and producing things around Python, you still get to code a little bit, right? Because you had recently, we're going to talk about infrastructure and deployment, but like in terms of actual Python, do you still get to keep your hands dirty?
Yeah, it seems like I would just be busy talking, right? But there's a ton of infrastructure and stuff going on. There's kind of a whole DevOps side, but you know, the TalkPython training stuff is it's basically its own SaaS, right? Evolving over time in lots of ways. I just noticed I was doing some stuff in GitHub. I'm trying something different. I'm always busy. You know, I talked about all these different projects, and then I have people working on the courses, and I've got, you wouldn't believe how much email, and it's always just stuff pulling me away. So I have like big ideas for stuff that I would like to add, and it's always like, well, maybe next week. So I was working on something I'm calling Platform Week, where turn off the email, have no meetings. Who knows? Maybe even I'll go stay by the beach or something and just kind of more alone. I haven't decided, but just sit down, come up with a plan. Like if I had 40 hours to just write code and sort of tackle the bigger problems that I've been thinking that I should, what would I do? So I was working on that and I realized just for the courses I'm on issue 1,690 or something like that. It's mostly me, but also a little bit of stuff is in there around, say, like our mobile apps where I worked with another developer and things like that. But that's a lot of code.
Yeah. And what is it now that it keeps you excited? Like when you're coding away and you're actually just focusing on the code side, what are the exciting bits that you like? Oh, yeah, I like doing that, or I like this.
Yeah. There's just always stuff to learn. There's always stuff to get better at. You think, okay, I've really got this web stuff nailed, and then HTMX comes out and you're like, oh, I got this changes everything, right? I know you both are big fans of that. And you know, like, okay, I got HTMX nailed. I got the web stuff nailed. Oh, maybe we could deploy it in a whole way better way. This whole thing I've been doing, you know, is I could completely change that as well. And it's never ending. I think the fun thing is it's, every time you kind of go through that process, it's better. Like Python is better. The web frameworks are better. The infrastructure and tools like databases and web servers all the way to the hosting, like the whole spectrum is just like, oh, this is even cooler than last time I dove into this aspect of it. And so it's worth doing times.
Yeah. The excitement is like, last few years, it's been like, oh, wow, we've got, you know, new layout things on the front end. We've got, you know, CSS finally catching up with where we wanted it to be. And, you know, and then on the back end, all the async thing stuff has come through and it's always fresh.
Yeah, absolutely. I just yesterday I talked about Mountaineer, the web framework. And a few weeks before that was Fast UI, not Fast API, but Fast UI from Samuel Colvin and team. And those are both super interesting projects. There was like Python deeply integrated with React. Interesting ways. I don't do a ton of React, but you know, like when you write a function in your web app in Python in Mountaineer, it automatically creates like an API connection for you and it generates a TypeScript, TypeSafe, like front end thing to call that and keeps them in sync. There's just a lot of neat stuff out there, right?
Well, it's good to have that attitude, right? Because I think you can also, after a decade plus, you can fall into the trap of thinking this is just reinventing what I already know, which is a little true, but it's also, you know, generally better, which is why people are taking the time to reinvent the same things.
Yeah.
But that might be more where if you're 3 years getting really good at something and then, you know, a manager says we're switching and get up to speed and you're like, I have a feeling that's more where that feeling comes from, or you're, you know, the market changes and it can take a little time to feel like you're catching up, even though you've been deeply in one of those areas.
It can, and if it's not your choice to go down that new path, it can be frustrating, right? You're like, we were really good with just server rendered code. What are we doing? Like, why do we got to change all this? And honestly, I still think that's true. I think it's pretty amazing, which I guess is why HTMX is also really interesting. It's not as bad in Python, though, right? I mean, we could be in JavaScript, not knocking the language necessarily, but it just changes so fast. The lifetime, you know, and backwards compatibility seems to be something that people are like, maybe if it's convenient, you know. I just saw that they're working on alpha on a Tailwind 4. I'm like, all that does is fill me with dread. I'm just like, okay, what is not going to work anymore that I don't quite realize?
I'm quite excited about the
combination of 10 classes are going to break.
Yeah, I'm quite excited about the Tailwind 4 because it looks like it's bringing it a step closer to CSS. It looks like, you know, using native layers rather than the Tailwind layers and things like that. So it might be, you know, that might be nice to, because it's not the case that you have to stick with your Tailwind forever. You don't have to do everything in JavaScript, right? But you can work it back into your style sheet. And if they go closer that way, I think it might take away a few of the kind of religious criticisms of it.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, it looks exciting, so we'll see. Will, are you a Tailwind fan? Do you believe in Tailwind?
I have a redesign of my main site that is not publicly live yet that's in Tailwind, but I have to say I'm not a Tailwind expert. So I worked with designers, imagine that, who did an amazing job on this site.
Yeah, that's so right. I think we talked about that on Mastodon.
Yes, that's right. Yes, you were looking for... Yeah, I used YupGup, mm-hmm. who are great, who do a lot of work in the Django space. So I highly recommend designers. They're a lot cheaper than programmers. And it's, I definitely wouldn't say I'm super comfortable with Tailwind, but I'm sort of really happy about that.
Yeah.
I have enough to deal with.
You're Tailwind interested?
Tailwind curious.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Curious, to that point of just like, I'm pretty familiar with Bootstrap. I've used a lot of Bootstrap, and there was a discussion of like, should we use Bootstrap? Should we use Tailwind? And it's like, well, I know that whatever it is, we'll probably have to change it in 5 years. And Tailwind seems pretty established and a little easier for me to maintain once someone else does it. But I don't have to worry about architecting it. I mean, so that was the decision. And, you know, it's a little annoying to have a separate server running to, you know, have NPM going, but it's not the end of the world. Like,
Yeah, that's true. It's not the end of the, but you do have to figure out, okay, well, there's these little scripts like watchers and stuff I've got to write.
Yeah.
And then deploying it like is, you know, it was a day to like fully figure out like, okay, like even just on Heroku, which is still like what I use. Like, it's like, okay, mm-hmm. wait, where's the thing for this? I mean, that's the, you know, we both work on courses. Like, I'm like, how does anyone figure this out? Like, why does this take so long? Why isn't there just like an answer? Like, I will pay money for an answer. Like, someone just like save me 2 hours for $10 or $20 bucks. Like,
yeah.
But I guess it's just, the change is too much, and maybe it's not worth anyone's time. But I'm trying to fight the don't change things attitude on all this.
Oh, just on that, I saw a thread this week, and it was from a front ender, and they were like, "Look, all I hear is front end's too complex. Front end's gone off the complexity cliff. Front end's crazy with its complexity." But what were it, they're like, their argument was, "Well, what were we supposed to do? Just sit there and not look for the better solutions, not try the better things, not progress?" And at each step, their argument was that, you know, it made sense that we brought in Webpack. It made sense that we switched to this. It made sense. And, you know, they were just searching for a better solution. And it's all right for us Python devs go, "Oh, you JavaScripters, you crazy." Was that kind of
crazy
take.
Bunch.
I think it's two things, right? It's the people pushing the envelope are large companies with big staff who have maybe needs that the rest of us don't have. So does your average website need all these things? Probably not. And at the same time, you know, selfishly, we all want to feel like we understand everything going on in our web app. But obviously, as it matures, that becomes harder and harder to say with a straight face.
Yeah. It's probably true also of the big teams. It's probably more true of the big teams that the people working on them don't necessarily understand everything, all the moving parts, right? Because you got team,
right.
Specialized team members that deal with like, hey, how do we keep it in production?
Right. Well, maybe that's a segue to infrastructure, because that's one of our big topics, and you have a number of notes to dive in. I guess, you've changed your infrastructure, or you're thinking about it? Where does all this research come from?
Oh, no, this is done. This is kind of the infrastructure equivalent of what I refer to as the platform week. Like, I'm just going to take some time, focus on this problem, put everything down, suffer the backed up inbox later, and try to dig my way out and get a bunch of changes. I think this was, how was it? What was really the impetus for this?
Yeah, I was going to ask, why dive into this, right? Like, where is that point where you say, you know, because you have traffic, but you're not Google level, right? Like,
no,
how do you
no,
decide,
no, certainly
okay,
not Google
it's worth,
level, no.
it's worth customizing things beyond just, you know, paying a platform as a service bill.
Yeah, absolutely. So just to, I don't know that I would say it's big and it's not totally small. I'll just give people a sense. We do, through all the TalkPython things, we do around 9 million Python-backed requests a month, and we do about 10 to 12 terabytes of traffic a month. So it's a decent amount, but it's not, it's certainly not Google. Like, that's a minute on Google or especially YouTube or something, right? But it's a non-trivial amount of sort of traffic, right? So for a while I had, so let's take a step back. So for a while, at least in the early days, I kind of had this, what I think is not really the way anymore that a lot of people think about. But I had this belief that the cloud was small commodity things, right? The cloud is best at giving you a bunch of small little things. They're super cheap. I can get a $10 thing here and a $12 thing there if I want to optimize the CPU to be an Intel, whatever, and so on. And I can piece my stuff together with that, right? So I have a server for this, server for that. I got some backend servers. I got some failover. So I got, and I ended up with like 8 servers sort of in that constellation of things. And I thought, okay, this is great. So I've got the main stuff. I've got failover servers. If I need to do maintenance and say like the kernel is patched and there's a security patch on the main one, I've got to reboot that server. There's not too many interesting tricks I can do besides just making it reboot. And so what do you do? So do you use some kind of load balancer to switch it over to the cheaper backup one or, you know, something like that, right? That was kind of how I was doing things. And it real I realized, like, I've got – yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Carlton.
I just wanted to bump in because, like, you said 9 million requests a month. So I just quickly did the math. It's about 6,000 requests a minute or something. It's quite a lot, right? So you can't just reboot your server because you've lost 6,000 requests.
It's a lot.
It's all right if you're like, just running your blog and it's like, oh, one person maybe. Anyway, carry on. Yeah. Sorry. So how do you handle the fall over and how do you handle the load balancer, you were saying? But
yeah. Well, I was just sort of cycling between these servers and using, you know, sort of IP magic and stuff like that to, you know, sort of DevOpsy stuff. But what I realized was, one, I have all these servers to maintain and I've got to patch them all. And it's just a bit of a hassle. And then, I mean, you could make a platform as a service argument. That's certainly a thing. And you could talk about Heroku, but there's advantages to not being a Heroku as well. And then what I realized is, well, if you got to take the database server down as one of those things, they're all going down anyway. You know, there's probably 10 seconds of downtime per month that's unavoidable unless I get into a more complicated database cluster with replication. And now it's like, okay, I'm not Google. I'm not YouTube. It doesn't justify that level of uptime. I'm willing to take 10 seconds of downtime a month. Very rarely, like more if I screw up something, but you know, which does happen, but not that often. But anyway, I'm like, there's kind of this single point of failure anyway. And I have all these servers. And then that was one half. And the other half was, and I think this is where a lot of interesting stuff is going to happen in the conversation here, is there's actually a ton of open source similar things to what you might use, right? So let me just give you one example, MailChimp. MailChimp used to be a cool little startup. You could get your mail over there and you could sign up people and you could make a community and it was amazing. And then it grew and it grew. And then it was bought by a financial company that just wanted to turn the screws on folks, from what I can tell. I'm sure there's people who don't just want to turn the screws, so no offense. But it's got a slightly different business model. And it doesn't have that, like, I'm supporting the small person anymore, right? And my bill is just going up like $100 every 2 months. I'm like, hey, guess what? Your bill is now $100 more, sometimes because there's more subscribers, sometimes just because, well, we've added a new feature that you're not using. So it's $100 more again, you know? Yeah. It was up to like, I don't remember, something like $600 a month or something. I was like, all right, this is getting out of control. Like, and so I realized there's like a couple of really cool options for just self-hosting something an open source version of this. All right, well, I've got these 8 servers. Where do I put this self-hosted thing? Well, I'm sure not going to put it like right next to anything else that has access to my database. That, because I'm not in control of that code. How much do I really trust it? You know, I trust it, but there's trust it and there's put it on inside the room with you. You know, like that animal looks friendly. Oh, it turns out it's really aggressive at night. I can't believe it's in my house. Like, what have I done? Right? Like that kind of thing. So I'm like, all right, well, I need to set up something to kind of manage that, right? Like, all right, well, maybe I need to set up another server, or maybe I should just, this is ridiculous, and I should start using something like Docker or containers or something. So, like, that's one half of the story. And the other one is I was interviewing or reading different people talking about, like, this cloud commodity, a bunch of small things, maybe that's not the right way. Like, for example, I got a chance to have Mark Rusinovich, the CTO of Azure, on TalkPython. We sat down and we were talking, and he's like, oh yeah, we're moving towards more big servers rather than a bunch of small commodity servers. And they have some that are up to ridiculous levels. Like single servers you can go get that are, you know, 1,700 core machines with many terabytes of RAM. And they every time they put out a new one, they have a different adjective for it. So it started out with Godzilla, then Super Godzilla. And now the one that they have that's really big is like Mega Super Godzilla Beast or something like that, right? But they're running out of ways to describe like how ridiculous it is. So that and the David Heinemeier Hansen stuff, like leaving the cloud. I don't know if people have been watching that, but like similar thing. We're going to get like a couple really big servers and we're just going to use modern software to sort of DevOps our way through this better then. And so I kind of went down that path because I'm like, all right, well, I want to take advantage of not just Python, but all these cool open source things for both running your code, for extending services, for getting away from unfair SaaS, to having not just unfair SaaS, but you know, your GDPR statement has, here is this other service we're sending your data to at a very high price we pay for the privilege of doing so. And then here is their GDPR statement and their cookie statement and their this and their that. And it makes operating an online property a little bit of a pain, a little bit fraught with that kind of stuff. Not to mention blocking, right? Like if it's some kind of API endpoint that uses their domain.javascript thing, and maybe that's blocked as tracking, right? So there's just all these challenges of integrating with other people's stuff. So there's a lot of advantage to running things yourself, but then you don't want to let the wild animal like into your house. What do you do?
Yeah, okay, good. So one thing I want to pick up on before we perhaps switch over to the container side of it is just on hosting your own email list. Is the big scary beast that they always wave at you is deliverability, is yes, getting your email delivered. And if you self-host, how do you handle those deliverability issues?
Yeah, that's certainly a concern, right? So people should disentangle two things. There's running your own mail server, and then there is running the database that holds the list of people on your mailing list. Yeah, and right. So, for example, one of the things that I chose, there's a ton of them you could choose, but I chose something called ListMonk, which is free, self-hosted, sort of Docker-first type of... I don't even think this one has a, hey, you can pay us money, ListMonk.app. Yeah, so when you go there, it says, well, how do you use the thing? It right there, it says, okay, what you do is you literally use this, say, create a Docker Compose YAML file that has a ListMonk latest, and it also has, you set up Postgres. I think it uses Postgres. There's basically two servers that you got to run there. Yeah, it uses Postgres thing, and then just the web app, which I think that's written in Go. Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's written in Go, but it doesn't matter because you don't have to think about it.
You just go there
and it says, here, use this is how you plug it into your infrastructure, right? As part of your system. So back to your question, Carlton. that plugs into what people are probably already using to deliver mail. So it has like a drop down for, are you using Amazon SES? Are you using SendGrid? Are you using Mailgun? Which you've already got your DKIM and PK whatever stuff set up, and you, because you're already sending a ton of mail out of that, right?
Yeah, right, okay.
Right, because that's the thing is that when you, like running a platform as a service, you have your transactional emails already, you know, if someone signs up, reset password, that kind of thing through, let's say, SendGrid, and then you can separately have your database that holds your newsletter, which you also send through the same. What is it, SES? What are they even called? There's some acronym for...
SES is the Amazon one, right? Simple email service.
But I...
There's something.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an alternative, an opposite of transactional email service, but yeah.
Yeah.
So but yes,
they send the emails.
Yeah, the email sender. Yeah, so Carlton, I'm not hosting my own mail thing. That seems fraught. And also, it's not
okay,
just
and then as long as you're well behaved. But,
yeah, exactly. And my reputation is 100% at SendGrid. So as long as I'm well behaved. Maybe it's 99.9 or something now, but...
I got to put on my old man hat. Like 2010, when I was at a company called Quizlet, we had millions of users and we had to do all the, I guess, primarily transactional stuff that we sent a couple marketing, in quotes, emails. And it was just like, just stored in like a PHP app. And, you know, it's basically impossible then, and it's worse now, to just send a million emails or 2 million emails unless you have... this built up reputation, right? Because Gmail, yeah. Yahoo, like it's undoable. And I think Mailgun actually had just come out of Y Combinator at the time. But like, yeah, so like you can send them, but no one's going to get them because
they're not going anywhere.
You.
No, they're not going anywhere. So, it's
it's a nice little gated garden there. But yeah, that's for anyone who's thinking, I'll just self-host it all. Like it's not going to go through because there are these guardians around reputation. And if you get a certain number of spam, yeah, this is what I tell like my non-technical friends. I'm like, if someone's sending you email, just flag it as spam and they will stop. Like they will hard stop. Because unsubscribe is just kind of like a option. It's like, please unsubscribe me. There's no force there. But you hit spam, their credit score gets dinged essentially and they will automatically pull it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I actually set up a thing that will listen to, it'll set up a webhook that'll listen to unsubscribe events across different things. And so, well, that's obvious, but spam requests and bounce requests and those types of things that are not typically sending back responses. And through SendGrid, they'll tell you, hey, somebody marks you a spam or something like that, at least on the major platforms, Google and Microsoft and stuff. And so you can then unsubscribe them so you don't keep sending it and keep adding to your bad score. And so that's some of the interesting things that you can do. It took a little bit of Python code to make it happen. But
it seems like that should be built into one of these services,
it's
right?
It's built into this ListMonk thing, but it somehow doesn't come back from SendGrid correctly. I don't know. I'm like, it matters enough that I'm going to just take an hour, write a little API that just listens to this email doesn't like you for some reason, unsubscribe them.
No, and is this primarily, this is for like marketing emails as opposed to transactional?
Yeah, exactly.
So the transactional you already had through, I forget which one you said.
SendGrid.
That was all SendGrid. This is right. Because the marketing ones, that's where MailChimp and ConvertKit and all of them come in. And yeah, there's a Django-hosted one, Buttondown.
Yeah, Buttondown.
You have to pay for it. But
certainly, I consider Buttondown as well, yeah. That looks cool.
We're going to have Justin Duke on... a little bit later to talk about it.
Awesome.
But yeah, that seems to be the progression, right? It's like, hey, we're indie, and then all of a sudden Intuit owns you.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And it's like free for the first couple thousand, and then it's like, wait, how much is my bill?
Yeah.
It's always struck me that email providers are quite expensive. You know, you look at them and it's always like, okay, it's only $30, but it scales up and it's like, oh, wow, actually it gets expensive.
But the transactional ones aren't that expensive.
No, the pennies.
It's the marketing ones.
Yeah.
The marketing ones, it's like 100x like markup. And it's like, you're still just sending an email. Like, and my issue is like, I want like a base version. Like, I don't want to do a drip thing. Like, I just want to send email. And I'll personally, I'll happily pay someone not to just do that. And, you know, so we're going to have to talk to Justin from Button Down and these other solutions, you know, because I'm not at a scale, but there seems to be no in between, you know, broadly speaking, yeah. right? It's really, I guess, designed for larger companies and the marketing departments, once they get hooked in, like they're not writing an API endpoint. They're not looking at this. They're just like, just throw just money at it and move on.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, I don't know, I guess that's just the space, but there's that whole area is just, I kind of feel like they're just overcharging. You know, you look at places like HubSpot right. and MailChimp, and they're like, you know what? It seems totally reasonable that it's $1,000 a month to have a few landing pages. You know what? I'm not really sure that that's true. Oh, by the way, you can pay that in 12-month, you know, yearly chunks as well. So it's like, wow, okay.
Right.
Thanks for that. Well, there's no loan. Yeah. I need a loan to get like marketing software.
Right. I mean, there's a company here in Boston that just IPO'd that's Django based or was originally Klaviyo with a K that I believe also does like if you look at a lot of like e-commerce companies, they handle marketing emails essentially. And I know is it still around? There's a company called Drip that was doing Drip emails.
Yeah, Drip is
that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But like Klaviyo is like that, but like $10 billion or whatever it is. So like huge companies. But yeah, I guess there just isn't a market for like solo or smaller places, right? They don't really care, right? And it's like, well, you can go open source if you can. Otherwise, we'll take your money. Yeah. Anyways, Button Down, shout out. We'll talk to Justin about it. I think he's trying to tackle that challenge, but the space in general doesn't focus on that. This episode is sponsored by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. An email sending solution with industry-best analytics, SMTP, and email API SDKs for major programming languages and 24/7 human support. Try for free at mailtrap.io.
So, Michael, you decided you were going to stick everything all on one big box. What kind of box did you get, and where did you get it? And is it a physical thing? Do you have to drive to the colo and change the hard disk at 2 o'clock in the morning, or is it
I think, you know, I mentioned the DHH, we're leaving the cloud, and those guys went and spent $500,000 on servers. Like, that's not... You're also not 37 signals probably for the general people listening who would consider, but it's totally reasonable to say, I'm going to go to somewhere like DigitalOcean or Linode or somewhere. You know, one of the things that has struck me is like interesting, but you often get sort of too deep into the machine and then you're stuck is just go to AWS and look at the console of services that are there. You know, it's like, you got to zoom in just to see what they are anymore. There's so many sort of thing, right? Like, what is going on here? And, you know, it's totally reasonable that, all right, this database thing is like starts at $20 a month. Okay, that's fine. And we got this functionless. And then, oh, we're going to need caching for this thing. Then over there. And then all of a sudden, your code doesn't run in general places. It only runs in this one particular cloud. And the aggregate of this, because you now started doing too many S3 transactions, reads and writes. So now that's expensive, but you got nowhere to go or whatever, right? Bandwidth is high. Then you're kind of stuck. And I think it can be frustrating. Also, it can kind of take you away from just the simple Python solutions. Like, then how do you even test that kind of stuff locally end to end? You know, it's like, well, I don't have all these. I know there's containers you can set up, but like at that point, you're running a different set of complicated infrastructure just to write code. So to answer your question, Carl, then just I got like a $60 server over at DigitalOcean and just put everything on that.
Right.
There's some really interesting
things. But you get a lot of stuff for a $60 server, right?
You do, yeah. It's 8 gigs, 4 CPUs. What's really interesting is the bandwidth. So if you did 10... Let me just do the quick math. If you did 10 terabytes of traffic on the CPU, the EC2 is actually not as expensive as it used to be. But if you did 10 terabytes of traffic on Amazon, it's $921 a month, right? It's 9 cents a gigabyte, right? Which doesn't sound that bad, but then you multiply it by big numbers and it goes up. DigitalOcean, you get most of that for free. It's like... bandwidth is like $50 a month. I was like, oh, that's interesting.
That's quite a big difference, no?
It's not a non-trivial difference. And, you know, it scales linearly with how much traffic. So as you get bigger, it just, it's different.
Why is that? Is that DigitalOcean trying to compete with AWS in one of the few ways they can, or what?
Every machine that you get, every basic tier of a machine that you get at DigitalOcean, I think Linode is this way too, but since the Akamai acquisition, I don't really know anymore. You get 1 terabyte of included bandwidth with each little machine you get. And if you get one big machine, I think I get 6 or 8 terabytes of credit for outbound traffic. Whereas on Amazon, it's like, well, it's just 9 cents a terabyte or a gigabyte. It's not so bad, right? But then it adds up. So
I think there is a quite generous starting thing for, I mean, most small sites wouldn't pay anything for bandwidth on.
Yeah. And even if you were a small site, like it just doesn't matter, right? But if you start shipping bigger things like MP3s and videos.
Yeah, video. As soon as you're hosting videos, you're like, ow.
Yeah.
Well, and you don't use, like, I don't know if it's still the case. For a long time, Vimeo had like a unlimited for like $99 a month or something. Is that a sigh there? Talk to me about hosting videos.
Hosting videos. So, yeah, I had some stuff going on with Vimeo for a while. Paid for their business tier where you could white label, rehost it. And it was actually a really good deal for a while, and it solved a problem because video delivery, CDNs, all that stuff is super hassle, right? Re-encoding stuff so it streams the right, Android, it wants a different size and format than it does on iOS, than it does on, it's a nightmare. So they handled it. I was happy to pay them. And then they changed their policy, like, oh, if you have too much bandwidth, then you're going to start paying. There was a famous example. I can't remember the exact details because it's been so long. But this is somebody who was not going through the business plan. They just put, like, as if you were on YouTube, they put up a video and it went viral. It was a creator type, not somebody trying to create a platform or anything. And they got a letter from Vimeo saying, you're going to need to pay us like $1,000 a month for the bandwidth that your viral video is costing us. And they're like, what? I just put, like, you're a video. We posted a popular video. It wasn't popular at first. It became popular. And yeah, they had some changes in policy that just really kind of put the quash on that. I don't remember the exact details, but around that time, it feels like it was 5 or 6 years ago that things changed there, and it didn't make any sense anymore. Kind of like MailChimp. Like, it was cool for a while that you could do stuff there, but things change.
Well, this is also Boston-based. There was another, like, more expensive, better Vimeo. What is that one called? There was like one
Wix,
other one, right?
Something like that?
Yes. Wix is the building. Wix, it was like building. That.
Something like that. I can't remember.
But its pricing was, even from the start, was like kind of outrageous. I think, it's probably back 5-6 years ago when I was looking at this. I was like, who can afford this? it's like big companies, I guess. Big companies with marketing departments that just want to pay money and have it solved. But yeah, I guess it had all this analytics and everything. And
Anyways. It's awesome for the right group, but not for the wrong group, I guess.
So what are you doing today? Yeah, you're right. It is Wix. You were correct. Yeah.
Okay.
They're still around. I guess I was thinking about Weebly. All these weird
names.
There's
something that's like Wix, though, for building web apps. It's like a Squarespace competitor. I don't remember exactly what that is. So basically, through this whole process, I realized, oh my gosh, there are an amazing set of open source projects that sometimes you can pay small amounts of money to, or if it makes sense, you could also self-host it, right? This ListMug example I gave you have to self-host it. But another one that's really, really interesting is the web analytics, Google Analytics alternatives sort of thing. Probably the best known one would be Plausible at plausible.io. You guys know that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, so those folks are based, I think, in the EU and are much more concerned about GDPR. And I think what you guys know, and Carlton, maybe you know, you live, they're in your neighborhood. There was some ruling, either France or Germany, that basically said Google Analytics violates the GDPR to some yes. effect. And then another one, which of those pairs that said Google Fonts violates the GDPR, right?
Right.
Which is even yeah. a little more subtle.
But you like, so the trick, I mean, I know more about the Google Fonts ones. It's something I've looked into and considered. And I always, if I want to host a web font, I will always download the web font and host it locally, because actually
they don't let you do that anymore, Carlton.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. No. You, I was there yesterday downloading a font. They've got
well,
download.
Oh, Google. Got, Google does. Google, yes. Yeah. But if you like, because I went through this with the design process, even all these fonts, I was like, we're talking to designers. I was like, I'll pay a couple $100 to download a font. And it's like, nope, you can't. Anything that's not Google Fonts, basically, it's a SaaS.
Fonts
it's,
as a service.
It's yeah. And it's so expensive, right? And I'm like, you know, like there's, I forget the font that, you know, OpenAI's font that they're using is, you know, I calculated the bill based on, like, obviously they're getting a discount, but it would be like tens and tens and tens of millions of dollars a month just for the font. And yeah, anyway, so just side rant, like, yeah, let me download the thing. And yeah, I guess Google lets you download them. But all these other fonts, I was like, oh, I want a bougie font. I love fonts. And I was like, nope, that's like basically not possible for the majority of, yeah.
Okay. So I always download them because I don't want to, for my, you know, even forget the EU regulation, I don't want to put my used, people come to my website in good faith. I don't want to then have tracking stuff embedded in there.
I'm 100% so with that, you know,
big megacorp can form their shadow profile. I'm just like, no, I'll download it, self-host it, and that's fine. So the thing with the analytics is like, which are the ethical ones? Which are the ones which don't do exactly that?
I'm going to leave some out for sure. But so plausible.io is really interesting. They've got a just analytics as a service, which I think probably makes sense for most people, right? But it's buried deep down in there. I mean, it's not buried, but it's not front and center. Click here to self-host it. But you can self-host Plausible as well. The one that I'm using is something called Umami, which is more...
Yeah, I've heard of that.
Umami.is. It has a pricing version where you can just go get it your own for $9 a month. Or you just go, it's got a GitHub 20,000 stars and fired up your Docker Compose file and off it goes. And what's really especially interesting about analytics is I actually took Google Analytics off like three, four years ago and just turned it off because I'm like, it is not just a privacy violation to basically have it, but it is also kind of useless because so many apps, web
people
browsers, pie holes, everything just block Google Analytics outright. And so you're getting a really partial view of what your web traffic is doing. But with anything self-hosted, you can put it on your domain and it just looks like part of your web app. So for example, for Umami, I self-host it in a container on the same big server with all the other things. I've got like 15 things running over there in there. It's on the same domain, the same IP address. So when browsers look at it, go, yeah, that's fine. That belongs to part of this web app, right?
Yeah, it's just a...
And you get near 100%. Unless you turn off JavaScript, you're getting almost 100% accurate view into what's happening in your world.
Which is obviously much more useful.
That's a pretty unique thing. Most things are not like that, but web analytics are so subject to this privacy blockers, tracker blockers, ad blockers, which I'm not ranting against at all. I think that they're serving a very important role. But, you know, as a website builder, you end up on the receiving end of, you know, other people misbehaving badly, so you're untrusted as well. Kind of like the same email story, right? You know, people have abused the system. We don't trust anyone anymore, unless you're Gmail.
But back in the day, you didn't have a web blocker, but then you had pop-ups, so we have to have a pop-up blocker, and it's just warfare. Like, I'm not turning it off ever.
I'm surprised there isn't like a documentary on like, you know, the dominant web blockers, right? Because the ownership structure is deliberately unclear, and it seems like they're owned by like Google and Apple, like, but it just isn't like for real.
Yeah,
you know, not to get too Joe Rogan on this, but Yeah.
No, come on, we need to boost the numbers.
The dark analytics state is there.
That's right. Yeah, the deep analytics.
Don't let deep analytics.
I'm pretty sure that I remember taking like 10 minutes once to look at it, and it was just like, well, we don't know who owns it, but there's all these carve outs for these companies, and
who would want to own it
and has a lot of money, like
we're gonna block everything except for our ads, you know, something like that, right? That's right.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
So I actually run NextDNS for my DNS, and that stops everything. That's beautiful. Even my television has ad blocking built in. All your iPhone apps or Android apps built in ad blocking because that network endpoint is unreachable.
So like Amazon Prime now for their videos, that you just get a blank thing when it tries to put ads on there?
I haven't watched any Amazon videos since they put ads on there. So yeah, I think generally the stuff that's in the stream is kind of coming through the same source, but... Yeah, most of it, you know, even if you go to some mobile app and you hit a thing, it opens up an embedded browser, like the ads are gone. Every now and then my daughter asks, like, Dad, could you put the ads back on the network for a little bit? I'm like, why do you want that? She's like, well, if I watch this ad, then I'll get a credit in my game and I can't watch the ads in my game because you're stopping. I'm like, we're winning.
I was thinking this because my kids, like, for the longest time, you know, they've never seen ads on a screen. And now one of these things or something they want to watch, and they figured out that my kids like Legos. And so now it's like, hey, I want this Lego. Okay, what does it cost? What?
$300.
Oh, my God. You know, like, so it's, but it was, you know, in a way it was this, is this golden time of kids not seeing ads. Like, you know, because growing up, like, the radio that, like, you just... bombarded with it, right? Whereas most kids, you know, well, I guess, you know, if you pay for YouTube Premium or get a family plan. But anyways, yeah. So when someone looked at that and was like, you would pay more to not see those ads.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, probably.
Exactly. So yeah, I think anyway, so back to the analytics, I think, you know, there's all these different ways in which that information either is somewhat ill-gotten by sending it through a big tech or just corrupted because it's so partial from, you know, the different levels of ad blocking. So I think that kind of self-hosting stuff is there. I'll give you guys a whole long, interesting list of things here in a second, but I want to kind of just step back for a second and talk about like this 8 little servers versus 1 big server. And if you think about, you could say, all right, well, the big server is roughly... every app has about the same RAM as it had before, right? At least in a sense, right? If they're all still using a decent amount. But if you have a bunch of small servers and there's some spike in, say, one of your APIs, or there's a traffic spike in one, like TalkPython has like a big spike for some reason. Python Bytes had one because some guy was trying to DDoS it the other day, but it was fine. I didn't mind. Anyway, if for whatever reason, good or bad, it has a spike. And it's on this sort of commodity, bunch of small pieces world, it quickly runs into the limit. Like, well, that server has 1 CPU or it has 2 CPUs or whatever it gets when you chose it. And that's it. But if you put them all together in some kind of like Docker cluster type of thing, those spikes almost never overlap, right? The reason that the courses would spike versus the reason that TalkPython versus Python Bytes versus the APIs that run the mobile apps, whatever, there's almost no correlation between the spikes of one and the other. And so each one of those has almost all the compute available to scale out and do its thing. So it's really interesting to think, you know, like I've got this little Umami Docker thing running and this ListMonk thing running and all the other apps and web apps running, and they might have these different spikes, but they all have like higher headroom to do whatever they need to do for less. Like I'm paying 40% of what I was for the 8 servers, the little baby 8 servers, to get one bigger one, and you get more compute out of it. It's really interesting.
Yeah, no, I like that. It's, yeah, love it.
Yeah, it's fun to think about. But so, all right. So I mentioned a couple of these things, and neither of them.
Just before you do that, let me jump in. So you're running, so you said 15 services on this box. So I presume that isn't just some sort of long running screen session with, you know, shell. It's 15 tabs open, and how are you managing
15 Docker containers, I believe. Maybe 17 with the different databases and stuff, but yeah.
Have you got some nice UI that, you know, helps you manage those or?
Oh, not really, but I it didn't come with one because you just got Docker and Compose and different things. But I used Rich, you know, the Python library.
Yeah, Wilma Hugan
and Textual, and did basically an in-memory join on the report that a bunch of Docker and Linux things return, and it'll create a table. And then with Rich, something that's really awesome is, one, you get color, as I'm sure you know, but what people maybe don't know is Rich has a context manager for live redrawing of content. So you say with live, here's a table, and then you just start changing the table, and it'll change the UI without even flickering or anything, just over SSH. So that's basically that. And are you all familiar with BTOP?
No.
BTOP is magic. So BTOP, it's github.com/aristokratos/BTOP.
Yeah, a monitor of resources.
Okay. Yeah, but what's amazing, they don't have, if you scroll down to the graphics section, like maybe half the way down that page there, it's, you know, this thing I described with Rich, this is not based on Rich, but it's like kind of that to the logical extreme. It looks like a Atari or Nintendo 64 game almost. And it's just live updating of all these different panels. Here's all your CPU across all, you know, individual and total aggregate CPU. Here's your network traffic, your processes. This is what your disk and memory usage looks like, all updating live with graphs and stuff. So like that's kind of the thing I've been using, is just like look at the server. And what's interesting is when you're running Docker containers, all the processes in Docker all show up as separate processes in the like the process monitoring tools. Right. So you can actually see this part of my Docker container, like this worker process for this service is using this much RAM and this much CPU, and here's the graph over time and stuff like that.
It would be super cool if, just thinking about like your custom stack here, it's almost like if some naive person came in and you just had these dropdowns like, oh, I'm using MailChimp, I'm using these different things. And then it was like, here's a recommended other, you know, I don't know, you wouldn't monetize it in any way, so what's the point? But like, because as much as things are custom, there is some degree of generality around all this, which, I mean, you know, Carlton, I almost hesitate to ask, you know, you have spent quite a bit of time on a Django specific thing, button that was going to do some of this for Django.
Yeah.
I guess it's just hard to draw that line and get enough people in where it's like, yeah, I'll pay, you know, it's not as much as all these services, but it's enough to someone put a wrapper on top of it.
Yeah, no, I think there's a market there. You know,
how's your project coming, Carlton?
Yeah, no, it's going really well. So I stopped fellowing, and I immediately, in order to pay the bills, had to pick up a new thing. So I've been working on a project called Paths, which is an app in the environmental and social governance space. But I'm deploying that with Button on exactly the tooling that I want to use, and it's all going great, and it's super. And I think there is a market there. It's just a question of productizing. So you build an app, and then you want to productize it, and it's sort of three times the time to productize something as it is to just build the app that works for you. And it's that bit that is tricky, because I'm already building one application as a full-time job. How am I going to then build another? Well, I slowly tick away at it, and I'll roll it out over time now. But it works well. It's lovely. I think there's a market there, but it needs somebody to sit down and, you know, have the time. And where do you get that time? without the funding to back it. And
just
then,
raise money. Just get some friendly VCs.
No, but as soon as you raise money, then there isn't a market there anymore. That's the rub. What have we talked about on this podcast? We've talked about MailChimp. Used to be cool, and then they sold out, and then it became really expensive. We talked about, I don't know, Vimeo, that did used to be cool. It was the best offer for hosting videos on the internet. And then obviously they need to make more money to satisfy their investors, and all of a sudden it's like priced out and it's corporate only. And it's the same in this deployment world. It's like Heroku. What happened to Heroku? Well, it got bought out by, you know, the big company there, and then they're like, we can't do this free plan because it just doesn't satisfy. And that's totally understandable. Note, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't know how much their policy changed, but like they kind of got down the same path.
Yeah, you can't have it both ways. Either it's a small bootstrap thing, which you need to kind of grow organically, or you take outside money, and then that you just can't serve the hobbyist developer or the small independent developer. You're looking at corporate. And there's no way around that.
That'll be our first question to Justin of Button
Down. Yeah. Well, no, but he's doing it that way, right? It's a small thing. Yeah. He hasn't
but
taken
it takes
loans
a lot of
in, money.
A lot of intent and a lot of... And at some point, right, like maybe you don't want to work on the same thing for forever, right? And so I guess, you know, and tech is so weird because it's infinitely scalable, whereas like a more real world example, like what is it, like the like oatmeal I like to get from this like Bob's something or other, it's this old guy on it. And like
Red
Bob
Mill.
Just, yeah, Red Mill, right? Like, you know, he could have sold to Megacorp, he sold it to the employees. So now it's employee owned. Like where I'm from in Vermont, there's a number of companies that have done that. But, you know, that means that Bob or whomever, he could have made a lot more money, right? But, you know, yeah. And I guess it'd be nice if there was some tech equivalent. I guess maybe there are some a little bit, but more around like agencies. I know like Torchbox is employee owned.
Yeah. Cool.
I guess it's really hard around products to do that in the tech space.
Yeah, and the stuff that has running costs, right? Infrastructure, bandwidth,
right.
Compute.
And if
themselves.
You raise any outside money, then it's going to, yeah.
No, but that thing about outside, as soon as you take the outside money, you need the bigger revenues and you need...
Yeah, the clock is like ticking on your 10X and you better find a way to get it.
But... Yeah, I mean, not to make this all about 37 Signals, but they famously took money from Jeff Bezos like way back in the day because I think they were facing some of these pressures and it allowed them to, you know, stick it out, right? Like maybe there's, you find a benevolent billionaire who will buy 10% for some amount of money.
You know, I like your Basecamp app. I want it to exist. I'll just make sure it doesn't go away. Something like that. Yeah. Their whole Leaving the Cloud series that David Heinemann and Hansen wrote is super, even if you disagree with them, it's super worth your time of looking through it. It's quite interesting. So you guys are, I'm sure, familiar with Awesome List, right?
Yes.
So one of the things I want to just give a shout out to is kind of like this whole thing we've been discussing, kind of that. So if people check out products.containerize.com, that is like an awesome list for, you know, pick your self-hosted thing. So you want to do blogging, here's the choices. You want a forum, these are all open source, self-hostable, right? Discourse, or do you want vanilla? Do you want, you know, NodeBB, or there's a marketplace. They're all alternatives to, you know, Shopify, I guess would be the marketplace equivalent, right? And they've like, this is the one that's voted most by the users. You want chat? Like Slack, well, Rocket.chat is like the winning one apparently here, but there's, you know, what is that, 12 other options. Transactional email.
Is it winning by GitHub stars, or they have some other?
It gives this little like thumbs up, and I think it's whoever runs this is like, this is the one we've sort of given our stamp of approval to more out of them. But
it's very cool.
That's interesting, right? But then you end up like, well, if I want to use any of these, like, well, what infrastructure do I run this on? You know what I mean? you've got invoicing.
You're back.
Yeah, you're back to that, right? But I don't know.
I mean, every one of these things, there's a massive learning curve to picking them up and taking them on, right? It's not, it's open source,
in general,
it's self-hostable, but it's not free.
No, it's not totally free. And I totally agree with that. But what I would tell you is, you will find a pretty common theme of, here's a Docker Compose file,
do you have a place that can run Docker Compose? If you can do that, then you can probably self-host this pretty well, right? You got to have some kind of backup, but almost always it's Postgres. So you just run a Postgres backup on the server you set up and figure out how to restore that later, whatever that means for them. You know, it's not as daunting. Once you start down this path, you're like, oh, I've already got 10 of these things running here. What's two more?
What's 11? Yeah, what's 11? Well, yeah.
And, you know, because it's Docker, like, you know, you don't have to trust it as much. You still got to trust it with your data, but it's not right in there with all of your other stuff on the inside of the firewall and those kinds of things. Yeah. And so it's not as risky, but it's pretty interesting to go down this. You know, one thing, I guess, also two things here. One is, have you heard of Alestio? E-L-E-S-T-I-O, Alestio? So it's not that cheap, but it's kind of empowering. It's this company that you say, what is your provider? It says hosted on DigitalOcean, AWS, Vultr, Hertzner, Linode, Scaleway, et cetera, even on-prem. And then you say, well, which open source project do I want? So do you want ClickHouse? Do you want OpenSearch? You know, whatever, Redis. And they'll manage the backups, keep it running, keep it patched for you, almost like as a service on your own infrastructure for like a bit of a cloud premium. But you just go in there and you type in one of these crazy things, there's a really good chance that they have it right there. I think it's pretty fascinating.
We'll have a link to that.
And it's all of these things, that cloud premium, it's like, well, what are you buying? What are you trading off? Because in my day, there was, when I was a youngster, it was literally a sort of old guy who like had a beard.
Had a beard. Yeah, you got really, a beard, of course.
No, but it was like, yeah, like it was a proper big beard and
recumbent bike, you know.
he had a full-time job and he was like, you know, whatever time of day, he had a pay, like it was never like seemingly never sleeps, but didn't do much, didn't speak much, but literally his job was to keep the actual physical server going. Mm-hmm. And so when the cloud came along and they were like, well, you could get rid of that guy, and that guy didn't get rid of because like he had, you know, he was just part of the furniture. You wouldn't get rid of him.
Now he just kept like the cloud going.
But that cost just disappeared. And so, okay, the cloud server was more expensive than running it your own, but it was a lot cheaper than hiring the system administrator.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so you think, oh, you know, this service here, that's going to be an extra few pence per hour. But hang on, what are you trading off? Are you trading off it took you 2 days to work out how to deploy this versus clicking it in there?
Or do you need to hire somebody to manage all these things? Or can you just like pay an extra $100 a month? Yeah, it's really interesting. One Django one that's really worth, maybe you've already had these folks on, but have you looked at Posthog?
Posthog, no.
Posthog. No, I've heard of that. No, we haven't talked about it.
I think I'm pretty sure it's self-hosting. Let me just double check.
Single platform to analyze, test, observe, deploy.
Yeah, it's self-hosting. Yeah, Posthog. What is the domain? The ending? Posthog.com provides open source product analytics, session recording, feature flagging, A/B testing, all of that as a service or self-hostable, and it's in Django.
Ah, right. Well, we've got to get them on then. Right. It's brilliant.
Doesn't that look interesting?
I had seen it before. I didn't know it was built in Django. So that's
I mean, that's what, isn't that kind of cool? Like even the three of us, right? Like who do podcasts on this, and it's like, oh, there's this thing with like 17,000 stars that we didn't really know about that a lot of other people knew about somehow.
And how do we not? Yes. Almost 17,000 GitHub stars and written. And it's a really cool looking app. Single platform to analyze, test, observe, and deploy new features for your web apps and stuff. So yeah, that looks quite slick. Let me give you all one more category of interesting before we close it out. Or we can keep going as much as you want, but before we miss it. And I know, Will, that you're a fan of the Heroku style of things, right?
Yes. I am.
And then you end up...
At my,
go ahead.
Yeah, I was just saying, I was put a preface with, at my scale, I'm more than fine.
And, you know, I know there was a lot of drama around Heroku. I don't really want to give any hate. Like, they shouldn't be required to run the internet for free.
Yeah, yeah, you exactly.
know, regardless if they're just run by one person in a closet.
And no one else does either. Exactly. Like, no one else really does either.
Exactly. You know, like DigitalOcean doesn't have free. They have a $4 server, which I don't know. To me, feels like free, but, you know, it's not free, right? It still covers it for like the super, super indie little sites and just little small things and so on. But as part of this whole deal, I came across Doku. D-O-K-K-U. Yes. Mm. Are you familiar? Mm-hmm. Doku?
Yeah. I mean,
this is why I was wondering familiar if you with it. Ran something like, if you used some kind of UI a bit like this, but you don't, you do it with the terminal, but.
Yeah. So Doku's pretty interesting. It's kind of, it's got this, you know, create your own, it builds itself as open source PaaS alternative to Heroku. And it's kind of similar. You create an app and then you create a proc file and you get pushed to some branch and that makes it go. I talked about that on Python Bytes and people are like, oh, that's interesting. And somebody wrote in, I can't remember the name of them, apologize, said, that's cool, but have you seen Coolify, Coolify? This is like one of the same things, but a little bit more full-featured and a little bit better UI and a little bit more supported. Self-hosting, alternative to Heroku, Netlify, Vercel.
I mean, that server. Covers a lot of features there.
Yeah, free SSL, automatic database backups, webhooks, automation, notifications, monitoring, all of that in just a Docker compose up.
Yeah.
Basically. Well,
let me ask you as an educator, like what do you tell people who just want to like learn web development, right? I mean, because like this is kind of the issue is like at the same time that most software engineering jobs are around infrastructure, actually, if around the web. But getting started, like, I don't know. What do you say? Someone comes to you and is like, I don't know what Docker is. I just have this. I'm so excited. I just learned Django, and I want to host something. And it could be, What do you say?
Well, let's put the data science folks off to one side, because that's a whole different level.
Okay, yeah.
Right? Because they don't even actually have a web app, but they need to somehow get it on the web, right?
I mean, turn this spreadsheet into a web app with CRUD and auth and everything.
Yeah, exactly. Which is more of a, but for the folks like, I have a web app. It does just what I want on my machine. How do I make it on everyone's machine, right? So I think there's two paths as an educator you send people down. One is just don't think about it. This is what a connection string looks like to a managed database server. You get pushed to Heroku or something, some platform as a service equivalent. Job done. That's kind of the, I want to make it happen and I don't really want to think about, worry about, or even hardly know about necessarily. Like, what do I need? I just need it to just go. And if I can get it here, these people will take care of it, right? That's the minimum path, I think. And that's probably the right path for a decent number of people. It's just like, I wanted to get it to go. The other side, this isn't what I've ended up doing more, and I don't know if people are like, Michael, why are you doing this to me? Is show them how to set it up on Linux. If you know how to set it up on Linux, you can run it on VMs. You can run it on, what do you got to do a Docker container? You put run or copy in front of all the Linux commands. You know what I mean? Instead of saying CP, the Docker file thing is copy. Instead of apt install, you say run apt install, right? Capital R-U-N is the front of that thing to make it a Docker command. And so if you understand Linux, you understand Docker, and that opens up all the, you know, containers as a service. It opens up Kubernetes if somebody else is running the cluster. Like it opens up that whole world, I think. But there's a higher bar to say like, okay, well, I'm a Windows person and I generally don't use the terminal and you're making me work in Linux with no UI. What has become of me, right? There's that challenge. So I think there's this bimodal. You want to send somebody, people to one end or the other.
I think there's a trade-off as well with the pass is that it's kind of like a dead end and that I've described it in the past, a cul-de-sac. You go in and it's great to begin with and it's lovely and pretty and there's flowers around mm-hmm. and a nice bit at the end. But then you get to the end and you're like, oh, actually, I want to do something further. And you have to kind of go back all the way out where you were to start again to get onto a more complex. Whereas if you go straight to a VM, it's slightly harder to get there to begin with, but you can grow an awful long way before you need to learn anything else at all.
And I 100% agree with that. Yeah.
The the sort of example that comes to mind is with channels, which is the async add-on or WebSockets add-on for Django. The number one problem we have is people having difficulty connecting to Redis because they've got a pass and they've got a Redis that they've spun up in the cloud somewhere, and it's not simple to connect because you're doing it over the network and it's got to be HTTPS and it's got to be this, that, and the other. Whereas nobody in the history of Redis had a problem connecting to Redis on localhost, right? It just never happened.
And yeah.
Like if you've got a VM, you can spin up Redis sitting next to it and you're off and you start, you never hit that set of problems until you're much bigger scale and you're like, oh, I need a much bigger Redis. Well then, okay, you can put Redis on a separate box. But by then you've kind of got the chops. Whereas people really struggling early on because they've gone the pass route and then they needed something which wasn't delivered by the pass in its sort of cul-de-sac of first offer.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think part of it too is it's enough to create a website and market it and do all those things like in of itself, and then to add in all this other bit. It's kind of like it's rare to have the success and the knowledge and the time to do what you've done, Michael.
Yeah.
Whereas most people, it's like on your own, put up a portfolio stuff and then go join a team and then, have the time to focus on an area. It's very rare to do all the things you're doing at the scale that you're doing. You have some help, but still it's usually most people are overwhelmed with.
No, I totally agree with you. And look, when I started my stuff, I ran it on Python Anywhere. And I'm just said, here's my code, run it. I don't want to think about it.
Also bought by someone else.
Yes, I know.
Anaconda, I think.
Yeah. And, then I slowly over time, kind of thinking like Carlton said, I need a little bit something different, right? I think it was something like, oh, we're going to have our maintenance period. Will it be down for 4 hours? I'm like, 4 hours? I'm not really psyched on that. Maybe I should learn a little bit enough to control my maintenance window to be shorter than 4 hours. That's a long time and stuff like that, right?
And I know we're coming up on time, but how did you dip your toe in, right? Because it does feel a little bit like a boom. Like were you able to do that gradually, or was it I need to
super gradual. It was how do I get
moving services? Yeah, and then
well,
keep
in the
database
beginning,
there.
It was just in the beginning, I just used SQLite because how read heavy is a podcast, right? It's not that read heavy. It's not write heavy. It's read heavy, right? And so that's actually pretty much fine for something that you update a couple times a week.
And it's only one person updating it, right? It's one person
exactly.
updating
and,
it.
And so me doing that. Yeah, exactly. And so I started out with that and I'm like, all right, this is easy. I can productionize this because I just let the file be there basically, run it on Python Anywhere and all right, well, maybe we need to move it to our own server. Okay, well, maybe we need a better database for analytics, like recording stuff that's happening and stuff and it grows, but it grows, you look back and I go, well, look at all this stuff. It's like, it's crazy. Why do you choose this? Well, it started like little baby steps. After you work with it a while, it's like, well, that's not for me, that's not that complicated. But I know that it is for others, right?
No, the best advice I ever had was from, senior when I was a junior, was like, don't only add the bits that you need as you need them. So, don't worry about varnish caching and stuff. You'll get to that you need it.
If you get to a scale that you care about that, then
you can
stuff.
Dedicate the time. Yeah.
You should be so lucky as to have a problem where you need that, honestly.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Right. Or as I sometimes like to tell people, when it's a problem, it will be overwhelmingly apparent. You don't need to,
How will I know when my database needs to scale?
When it becomes unusable. Premature optimization, there's a quote on that.
And that's true in code, and that's true in how you try to run your code.
We could keep going on and on, but we're a little bit over time. We'll have links to all these things. We'll put a link to you have, you mentioned HTMX, you have a relatively new Django HTMX course that folks should check out. I hope that's doing well for you.
Yeah, it's doing well. Worked with Christopher Trudeau on that and it's going well.
Yes, he's kind of, he's like your Django person, right? He does.
Yeah, more
or less. He's done a lot of stuff. Yeah. Not to limit him to that, but I, when I see TalkPython stuff that it does Django, I'm like, oh, it's that same person.
That's Chris. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So thank you for coming on our podcast. Of course, you have your podcast, Python Bytes, Talk Python. We'll have links to everything, training around Django stuff if they need it.
Mm-hmm.
And this was really fun. This deployment is such is just an infinite topic. And I think for you to come in as pretty much a solo person at scale, that's a really interesting perspective as opposed to someone at a large company who came in late, you know, didn't start from the beginning. And it's just like, well, here's my little piece of it. But everyone wants to know, how did you get there?
It's really interesting to think of. I mean, my takeaway is it's so easy and so affordable. I guess easy is not the right word. It's so accessible, right? You know, for $100 a month or something, you end up with infrastructure that looks like world-class infrastructure, right? It's ridiculous. So it's all within reach, and hopefully people got some cool resources as well.
Well, thanks, Mike.
So we are at DjangoChat.com, and we'll see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is sponsored by Mailtrap, an email delivery platform that developers love. Try for free at mailtrap.io.